Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
And it's a Monday morning of Thanksgiving week, November 22nd, 2021. Hope your week is going well so far. Stay tuned to this network for all the latest news and the updates as we move into this beautiful holiday weekend, and wishing you an early and a very safe Thanksgiving, especially if you're traveling. But again, stay tuned here for all the latest information and developments. We have a jam-packed show today, and a few changes in the rundown, as we say in the biz, because of breaking news over the weekend. I'm sure many of you are familiar with what happened on Friday when the 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who was charged with killing two white men and also injuring another, he was acquitted of all the charges, all five charges, found not guilty. And when this whole incident broke out last summer, as with many of the cases related to the riots and other incidents that happened last summer, the media put forth a narrative that they continue to pound today, even after the situation on Friday when you had this jury finding this young man not guilty. Now, the whole idea of whether he should have been there, the whole idea about guns, that's a separate discussion. But what we need to look at is the way the vast majority of the media are doing the same thing here as they did with the Nicholas Salmon case and so many other cases. They are saying the exact opposite of reality because they're putting forth an agenda. And so we're going to be discussing this. We were able to grab an interview with Todd McMurdy. He is the attorney who represented and still represents Nicholas Salmon, the Covington Catholic High School student. You remember that whole incident a few years ago. Actually, who's been weighing in, by the way, on the Rittenhouse case. And he was immediately accused of being a racist, a supremacist, after being actually confronted by a Native American activist. And when all was said and done, when the full video was released of what happened at the March for Life, you remember that year, it came out that the exact opposite was the actual reality. He wasn't agitating anyone. He was standing there literally waiting for a bus with other high school students from Covington Catholic. And he was singled out by these activists and was portrayed as someone who was a racist, who was a white supremacist. It was sheer conjecture and confirmation bias on the part of the press. We've talked about this a great deal. But now you have the same case with Kyle Rittenhouse, and you have many in the legal profession saying that it was a clear-cut case of self-defense, and it never should have been brought to trial in the first place. Now, what does this mean for all of us as Catholics? Well, there's a lot of things that we can look at in terms of what the Catechism says about self-defense. There's also a great deal of great resources available to us. Always, always, always look to the Church. I'm going to share with you when we interview Todd quotes from the Catechism regarding media usage. I also have a couple of quotes on self-defense, but we're mainly going to be talking about the media today and how they are manipulating, how they are using this to put forth an agenda. And unfortunately, one too many people are believing it, not even looking at the facts of the case. And what does this mean? And how do we take the media? It's a responsibility they have. We should be able to expect to turn on the news and hear the truth. What do we do about this, and what's in place to prevent more of this from happening? We'll talk all about that with Todd, and also sharing with you some important resources on how to discern the media properly from the Church and many of our leaders, including Pope John Paul II. So that's coming up. We're also going to be talking with, right after the news, with our dear friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen from EWTN, and he's going to weigh in on the Eucharistic document that came out of the USCCB annual fall meeting last week, his thoughts on it, and also the way some media are covering this. And as Father John mentioned on Friday, Father John Mercado, if people are thinking that this is supposed to be a directive from the bishops to all the other bishops of how this is supposed to be handled, then they're not understanding how the USCCB operates and what their role is, because they are not a quote-unquote governing body. So we'll talk more about that with Matt. I do want to get right into the news, though. In the weather, nothing major happening across the country. We're going to see some cold fronts moving in, maybe some rain and snow in some areas, but nothing major. We'll keep you posted if that changes. Right now, though, because of the tragedy last night in Wisconsin, we do have some breaking news that we need to get to right away. So let's do that. It's a Monday morning, 5 minutes past the hour. It's Catholic Connection, a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN. CatholicNewsAgency.com has more on this developing story. A Catholic community in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee among those impacted by a horrific incident late yesterday. 5 people are dead and more than 40 others hurt after an SUV plowed into a Christmas parade yesterday in the early evening about 20 miles outside of Milwaukee. As reporter Megan Fitzgerald tells us, some schools in the state will be closed and special prayer services held later today.
The Archdiocese here has issued a statement saying that among those who are injured is a Catholic priest as well as several children who attend their Catholic schools.
St. William's Parish in the Archdiocese explains that parade was being live-streamed on Facebook, and the Catholic community at that church and in the community around that church is going to be holding a live-stream prayer service today at St. William's Church, and this is after a rosary was said and special prayers offered at the parish last night.
So we pray that God's blessing, the blessing of Almighty God, will be poured out for each and every one of you, for the city of Waukesha, for all police officers and first responders, and we pray for all those doctors, nurses, CNAs, all those who've come rushing in, whoever they might be tonight, to be your healing power. And so, Lord, we pray that your healing power will just radiate through the city, especially touching all the hearts so deeply hurt by this and all those most in physical pain right now, for your healing power, Lord. Through the intercession of our dear blessed Mother Mary, Our Lady of the Rosary, and Saint Joseph, and the holy angels, may God bless you, Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
St. William's Parish there also planning to provide counseling and support for parishioners following that tragedy. Meanwhile, Dan Sheeman reports the SUV has since been found and a person of interest in custody. Police aren't giving too many details. They are going to be holding another press conference this afternoon.
Holiday celebration brought to a sudden, terrible end.
Our community faced horror and tragedy in what should have been a community celebration.
It was late Sunday afternoon in Waukesha when the red SUV plowed through barricades and into the parade. Police tried to stop it.
An officer discharged his weapon during the incident. No bystanders were hit by that gunfire. It's been nearly 3 weeks since the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments against a Texas heartbeat bill, and legal experts are saying it's possible the high court could issue a ruling on that measure today. The measure bans most abortions in the state since a heartbeat is detected around the six-week mark, the bill allowing private citizens to sue anyone who helps facilitate an illegal abortion. With Thanksgiving approaching, today could be the last day the court could decide on the Texas cases before they hear more arguments on abortion. The case over Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban is set to be heard on December 1st. Christian Aid Ministry says 2 of 17 people kidnapped in Haiti are free. The Ohio-based organization saying it only has limited information, but that the 2 people released are safe, in good spirits, and being cared for. The organization also saying it cannot give the reasons for their release, where they are from, or their current location. They were kidnapped on October 16th while working to set up an orphanage near the capital of Port-au-Prince. The gang that kidnapped them has been demanding $1 million each for the hostages. The group praising God for their release and asking believers to continue to pray for the safety of others. And the 18-year-old acquitted of killing 2 white men says his case was about self-defense, not race. Kyle Rittenhouse, who was acquitted of all charges related to a riot after the police shooting last year, said in an interview airing tonight on Fox News he supports a Black Lives Matter movement as well. And Pope Francis asking young Catholics to be the critical conscience of society. During Mass in St. Peter's Basilica, the Pope asking young people to swim against society's current without turning into perpetual victims and conspiracy theorists. Instead, the Pope asking them to swim against the current by finding their freedom in Jesus, the Pope making his comments on the 36th World Youth Day there. 9 minutes past the hour, breaking a few minutes early so we can have some more time with our friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen weighing in on what happened last week in Baltimore and the U.S. Bishops Conference, more specifically the document that was released on the Eucharist. We'll be right back.
When a kid loses a tooth, it's exciting. But an adult has some serious decisions that needs a caring, faithful, and family-oriented dentist like Dr. Maddie with Advanced Dentistry Center. Here's what Dr. Maddie says to those that are deciding between bridges and implants.
While bridges only last 8 to 10 years and damage adjacent teeth, implants last up to 30 years and help prevent bone loss. Plus, they look more natural.
Extremely natural, with Dr. Maddie, who practices the art of dentistry at Advanced Dentistry Center. Conveniently located at 13 Mile and Telegraph, make the decision to call 248 248-
334-9592 or click AdvancedDentistryCenter.com. Mention Ave Maria and receive 10% off dental implants. Be comfortable knowing that Advanced Dentistry Center's goal is to provide you with the most up-to-date treatments to help you look and feel your best. That's 248-594-9592.
You know, Ave Maria Radio is your Catholic radio station, and we'd like to make it even better for you. Your feedback is really important to us. Just go to our website, AveMariaRadio.net, and look for the button labeled 60-Second Radio Survey. It only takes a minute to fill it out and send it to us. Again, go to our website, AveMariaRadio.net, and look for the button labeled 60-Second Radio Survey. We'd really appreciate it.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Dr. Matthew Bunsen, noted best-selling Catholic author, historian, Catholic historian, speaker, really needs no introduction, but he is our executive editor and the Washington Bureau Chief for EWTN News, and he's with us to examine the bishop's document on the Eucharist. Matthew, always great to have you on the program. And I was talking with a wonderful priest, and you're very familiar with him because he's here on our airways, Father John Ricardo, and he hadn't had a chance to read the entire document. From what he was able to glean from speaking with some bishops and from what he did see, he thought it was the statements he saw were very strong, and I've also interviewed a few other priests in my first hour of my program. Maybe I'm missing something, but I thought it was a very clear document and pretty strong. Your thoughts?
It was. The thing that we always have to remember is that the bishops did exactly what they said they were going to do, which is not to try to wage war on Joe Biden, which was the sort of the meme that was out there, but really to lay out a teaching document that reiterates very strongly, I think, the real presence of the Eucharist, as the title says, the mystery of the Eucharist in the life of the Church. And the two big parts, of course, the first is on the gift, which talks about the sacrifice of Christ, as well as the real presence of Christ. But I think the most important part from a personal standpoint is the second part, and that is our response. And there we get into a very thorough discussion of how we are supposed to respond to the Eucharist.
Right.
In a comprehensive way. And it includes what we would expect, and that is our need to be worthy to receive. And why this is a matter of controversy remains, to my mind, something of a puzzlement.
In terms of the bishops not coming out with what some people were hoping for, a directive for all the bishops, and I was chatting with Father John Ricardo about this on Friday as well, it was my first question out of the gate when we had him on, it seems to be that people are not fully understanding the role of the USCCB. Not that we don't want them to teach and instruct, because they do that,
right.
They're supposed to do that, but the USCCB is not a governing body that issues edicts, and I think there's some confusion or people putting it out there, some outlets who call themselves Catholic, giving the impression that there was a huge disappointment because the bishops did not issue this, you know, across-the-board instruction.
Right. Well, first we get to what is the function of an Episcopal conference, and that
right.
is to bring the bishops of a country together. They can issue statements. Some would argue that perhaps the USCCB issues too many statements, but that's sort of a matter of opinion. But they do weigh in on the important issues of our time, but in a way that they do not have the authority to mandate what individual bishops can do, only under the most very limited canonical circumstances. And that goes to the very heart of what an Episcopal conference is. And as a result of that, this document is intended for all Catholics, but it's especially intended for the bishops to be able to have a teaching document that they can go back to their diocese with and say, please read this.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can hand out to pastors and say, please read this. Now, we also have to see this document within the wider context of the Eucharistic revival. We can talk more about that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be seen as a kind of totality of what they're trying to do here, and that is to revitalize, to reinvigorate our love and the importance of the Eucharist. And from that standpoint, then, it's up to the individual bishops to do what they will in their individual diocese. And that's right. The way it has always been, especially when dealing with politicians or those who are publicly obstinate in sin, publicly dissenting from the teachings of the church. It is and remains the authority of the local bishop to have those conversations and to take the appropriate action based on the specific circumstances of an individual politician.
Absolutely. We're talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, executive editor and Washington Bureau Chief for EWTN News, about the Bishops' Conference gathering last week and the Eucharistic document. And I think expecting particular politicians to be named is really, that to me is a misunderstanding of the role as well, because obviously the most prominent right now, and they have been for the last few years, but especially because he's in the White House, of Joe Biden, and of course Nancy Pelosi as a House Speaker, and very powerful person, the third most powerful person in the world, if you think about it, behind the president and the vice president. But if that's the case, if we name them, then what about all the other Catholic politicians or people in public life that are claiming to be Catholic and doing just the opposite? So where do you draw the line?
Right. You'd need a separate document just to list all of the politicians who are doing things that are directly contradictory to the teachings of the church. Mm-hmm. By way of an example, we can go back to 2004 and the great controversy that surrounded the then candidacy, and he won the Democratic nomination, of John Kerry,
right,
who was a Catholic, is a Catholic, but who also, like Joe Biden, like Nancy Pelosi, is a absolute advocate for abortion, for gender ideology, to use the phrase that Pope Francis uses. And there was a document in 2006 called, Happy Are Those Called to Your Supper, the Worthiness to Receive the Sacrament. And there was some discussion at the time, well, why didn't they name John Kerry, for example, in that type of a document? And we go back to, all right, suppose that they had, just for purposes of discussion, we would now be looking back how many years? 15 years,
yeah.
To a document that would be naming somebody that the average person today has barely ever heard of.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we are time stamping what are essentially and have to be timeless teachings on the Eucharist and the implications of those teachings, so that this document and any document like this is valuable for all the years going forward, that we can look back and say, yes, in 2021, the bishops issued The Mystery of the Eucharist and the Life of the Church. It's a beautiful document, and it hits on important principles without falling into the trap of looking at where we are right now as a snapshot in time, but what we're all called to be as Catholics in culture.
Let me give you another example, because at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to attorney Todd McMurdy, representing Nicholas Salmon, and his many defamation lawsuits, some of which are still pending, about the media. I'm so encouraged when I go to church teaching always. For example, I just went to the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the first hour of my program, my editorial segment, the use of social communications media. Now, in the same light we were talking about, for example, the Eucharist, you could easily, within these paragraphs from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, say, well, gosh, the church should insert, particular outlets that we don't like. And I'm not going to name them to give them free publicity, but why didn't you name this one? Why not name this one? But these are timeless teachings. And you go back to the Catechism, and it's simply amazing. Here's paragraph 2497. By the very nature of their profession, journalists have an obligation to serve the truth and not offend against charity in disseminating information. They should strive to respect with equal care the nature of the facts and the limits of critical judgment concerning individuals. That is so obvious about what's happening right now, not only with the Rittenhouse case, but with everything in the media.
Right. And you go back to the principles laid out by the Second Vatican Council Inter Mirifica.
Yeah, I love that. I mentioned that this morning as well. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. Where we have these guidelines that are as valuable today as they were when they were first promulgated by the Second Vatican Council.
And are so evergreen.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, for example, in this new document on the Eucharist, the bishops talk about the importance of personal and moral transformation. And in particular, the role of the laity to transform social relations in accord with the love of Christ. But then it adds that lay people who exercise some form of public authority have a special responsibility to form their consciences in accord with the church's faith and the moral law and mm-hmm. to serve the human family by upholding human life and dignity. It then goes on to quote the Catechism of the Catholic Church about what we are called to do specifically, and quotes Pope Francis about a throwaway culture. So these are important lessons, important principles that are supposed to guide us as Catholics, but in particular to guide any Catholic who holds a position of public authority and how they can begin bringing these timeless teachings into the public square to influence culture. And these principles are going to be as valid 10,000 years from now as they are today.
Right, just as the documents that we're referring to regarding the media, they are so, so timeless, and they're so important. But the problem is, and let's be honest, even with this document, so many people are not going to pull it out and read it. They're just going to look at their favorite news outlets and say, well, they did this or they didn't do this, and so therefore it's not good enough. We have a responsibility to pull this up and read it and to talk to our leaders about it and to encourage them to apply it. And I think that's the important thing. How is your parish, how is your community, and how are our bishops going to apply this? And to, I don't think enough emphasis on some of these outlets who were complaining about the document. They didn't put enough emphasis on the big Eucharistic celebration that we're having in this country, that there are major efforts going on to get us back to who we are as a people in the church with the Eucharist and the body and blood.
Well, that's right. And this is that plan for a Eucharistic revival that in 3 years will culminate with a Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if this is anything like an international Eucharistic Congress, and it on the scale and scope, I think it'll be very similar to one, the impact that that can have, especially in the lead-up to it, where you're going to have years dedicated to helping Catholics to deepen our understanding of the Eucharist. We're going to have priests who will be going out to preach on this. We'll have the patronage of Blessed Carlo Acutis, who is this great patron of the love of the Eucharist. So we're building this framework of a revival that, if we do this right, can really culminate in a profound moment for the Church in the United States in this Eucharistic Congress. And I think it is not an accident in terms of providence and timing that this would be in 2024, when we are likely to be in the middle of what will be another rancorous
election
and bitterly mm-hmm. divisive election.
Yeah. And I also think that we have to be careful not to accuse those who are trying to help us understand the document and what the Church does in these types of situations with the USCCB or other organizations within the Church, that we're trying to dismiss the issues in the Church. We're not. I mean, the whole reason EWTN exists and Ave Maria Radio and all of our affiliates is to educate and to enlighten people regarding the teachings of the Church, because there has been such poor catechesis. So it's looking at the reality, again, the reality of the situation. What does the Bishops' Conference do, and what do these documents mean to us and to people understanding the facts? And then, okay, how are we going to apply this in our own faith communities?
Right. And how can we support our individual bishops in doing that as well? Because as the shepherds of a diocese, they have the obligation to teach. You know, to teach, sanctify, and govern. And teaching is something that, as a church, I think you and I can both agree, we have not done an especially great job at for a number of decades now, many decades. And so a document like this then gives us that chance to step back and say, all right, here is what we believe, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
And the urgency to it, I think, has assumed an even greater sense of importance, precisely because of the confusion and, I'll use the phrase in the traditional theological sense, of scandal
mm-hmm.
That has unfortunately surrounded the emergence of so many pro-abortion and other dissenting Catholic politicians in sort of mainstream political life. Catholics are confused at a time when our levels of formation are already very poor. I mean, we can cite our own EWTN News Real Clear Opinion Research poll, where 50% of Catholics neither understand or believe in the real presence of the Eucharist. That is a massive failure on our part.
Mm-hmm.
And we can lament this, but the question then is, what are we going to do about it?
What are we going to do about it? Yeah, that's the bottom line.
And this document and the Eucharistic revival are both intended to help that.
All right. Matthew, thanks so much. Great clarity on this. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Executive Editor and Washington Bureau Chief for EWTN News, examining the bishop's document on the Eucharist, and we'll have more on this in future weeks. Matthew, thank you for your time, as always.
Always great to be with you. God bless.
All right. God bless. Dr. Matthew Bunsen. And, of course, coming up next, as we mentioned, speaking of timeless documents, taking a look at what the church teaches on media usage, how the media are supposed to do their jobs. The church has something for us on everything, and I hope you'll jot down some of these resources that I'm going to give you. Another thing to read in addition to the Eucharistic document. So important how we're receiving information, whether it's about how the church is reported, but also such as major stories that are happening right now in our culture. We'll be right back. Todd McMurdy, the attorney for Nicholas Salmon, joining us for the rest of the show today. Welcome back, Catholic Connection. It's a Monday morning, a busy day, Thanksgiving week, November 22nd, 2021, the Feast of St. Cecilia. St. Cecilia, pray for us. Had the opportunity to interview attorney Todd McMurdy more than once during the whole incident and afterwards involving Nicholas Salmon, a young Catholic high school student from Covington who was at the March for Life, and you remember that story. He was waiting for a bus with his fellow classmates, and there were some Native American protesters, activists, that approached him. And when a portion of a video on that encounter was released, the media narrative was a white supremacist, a racist boy from Kentucky at a right March for Life, a conservative event, wearing a MAGA hat, that he was mistreating, disrespecting this elderly Native American. When the truth were told, when the video was released in full, a completely different picture emerged. The reality emerged, and we learned that just the opposite was true. Nicholas Salmon's family was threatened. He was threatened. They had to move out of their home, and he sued and successfully actually settled with CNN a very large amount, from what we understand. Obviously, they can't reveal that amount for various reasons, but Todd McMurdy has been involved in that case since the beginning and has also been doing some great interviews since the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict was delivered on Friday. And Todd, what I'm seeing, I was telling you during the break, we've been chatting online over the weekend in preparation for this interview, it just really breaks my heart as someone who worked in the secular media for 20 years. And, okay, like, I wasn't perfect. I'll be right out there. Nobody is perfect. But at the same time, it was drilled into me many years ago, and I'm out of college now 40 years, that you have to have the facts. You have to have the facts. You have to put your opinion aside. You have to be objective. You have to at least try for objectivity, although nobody is perfect. And what we're seeing now is not only the complete opposite of that, but now they are just wreaking havoc on people's lives time after time after time. You saw this with Nicholas. You're still dealing with it. Your thoughts after the verdict came down, and also the whole coverage of the Rittenhouse case. Just your thoughts in terms of the media and how they handled it. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Teresa. Thanks for having me. You know, my thoughts of, you know, following the Rittenhouse trial and the verdict and the aftermath are, you know, it seems that the media in some kind of, you know, violent spasm still cannot accept the fact that a jury found him innocent. There have been a whole host of terrible defamatory comments about him from, you know, mainstream media outlets, and people have kind of, you know, lost their perspective on these things. And I think that's really indicative of the media in general when you get onto the issues, you know, the issues of kind of the false allegations of racism against everybody. You know, they're really pushing that point hard and they can't come off of it. And when they lose, you know, they don't want to accept it. So it's more of the same, but I think that, you know, for my work for Nicholas Salmon, and then hopefully Kyle Rittenhouse hires himself a good lawyer and pursues these claims on his end, you know, I think that we need to just keep pushing back legally, because that is one route that we have right now to try to hold them to account for, you know, the fabrications and lies that they perpetuate.
What's so tragic about these cases in so many levels is that they're not dealing with reality, and people, you know, walk in lockstep. Some people, for example, I'm looking at these protesters who were taken to the streets in these various protests, and each person that was interviewed was talking about racism and white supremacy, and yet all the people involved in this case were white.
Yeah, yes, it's absolutely shocking. I mean, I've heard people describe the whole belief in you know, the indelible stain of racism on white people as being a moral panic. They've kind of lost touch with reality. And so they keep pushing this thing, and that's just all they can think. I think as well, if you look more broadly, you have, there's a lot of intentional conduct by the media to use any circumstance to portray white people as indelibly, systemically racist, and, as a way to try to gain control. And I think if you look at the Nick Sandman case, here the facts were available, right away as to what actually happened. Mm-hmm. And instead, mm-hmm. we went on this wild journey of accusing him of being a racist. And, I think that the media especially likes to punish children. I think that they like to go after them because it's more shocking. I think mothers see young men being attacked the way Nicholas Sandman was and the way Kyle Rittenhouse was. And it's so shocking that it kind of creates and enforces a silence upon people where they're just simply unwilling to stand up for themselves for fear of this happening. And, I think there's a lot of shock value in attacking children. And I think that when the media has an opportunity to do that, they kind of double down, as they've done in both of these circumstances.
Mm. We're talking with attorney Todd McMurdy, representing Nicholas Sandman, in his case against CNN and other media outlets. Now, Kyle Rittenhouse, as is the case with Nicholas Sandman, they're not public figures. And also, they are in a situation where I would think that they have some very, very good grounds to sue. So we only have about 2 minutes before we take our first break. But there's defamation, there's libel, and there's slander. How do you discern when you're looking at a case like this? Do you include all? Do you include one? What does that mean legally?
Well, slander is when you speak ill of someone.
Right.
Libel is when you
print.
When you write something bad
right.
about them. And defamation is those combined. When you look at this case, what you want to look for are statements of fact that are false. In other words, for example, he is a member of a militia. That's false. So, and that's also defamatory, because if you believe that Rittenhouse is a member of a militia, then you think less of him in general because you see him as a person different than what he is. And things like that are a basis for bringing a defamation claim. He's been called a vigilante, and definitionally he was not a vigilante, but it's still kind of a pejorative phrase designed to diminish his character or somehow, show that he's still a bad person. What they're trying to do through all these defamatory statements is just make, Rittenhouse kind of the personification of this white supremacist racist character. And even after the loss, they're continuing to do that. So I think there's a lot of those phrases out there. I think they've called them, like a school shooter, things like that, that are available, for lawsuits. And, there have actually been some even worse statements that have come out of the media even after the verdict. So they keep lining up new lawsuits for themselves with these statements.
Yeah. And I think it's really important, and we could talk more about this when we come back from the break, the other lies that they're perpetuating in terms of, now they're obsessed with borders, which I find very interesting, when they're not obsessed with borders at all when it comes to illegal immigration, but they're talking about him crossing state lines, making it sound like he came across state lines with the gun, which he did not. He lived part-time in Illinois. He came over to Kenosha and wanted to help with the situation. This is what came out in the trial. I'm just speaking fact. This is not opinion. And yet the media are not reporting any of this, and also the gun. And you can have a separate debate on guns and how you feel about that, but the gun he had was legal. And so what people, I think, need to understand, and I'm not an attorney, but I've covered tons of criminal cases and sat through hours and hours and hours of testimony, cross-examination as a reporter. You base it on the facts. This is not to make a societal statement. This is not to rule on overall issues. What happened? Did what they're claiming happen? And can you prove it upon a reasonable doubt? And this is what is never, the media totally miss this. It's all about, none of that matters, because it's a circus to them and it's about pushing an agenda. And we, especially as a people of faith, have to discern properly. And as Archbishop Shep Hugh says, we need to know how the media works so they don't work on us. More with Todd McMurdy when we come back, looking at this issue of the way the media are covering and what we as Catholics are to do about this. The Church has beautiful teachings on this. We'll be right back. Paragraph 2499 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Moral judgment must condemn the plague of totalitarian states which systematically falsify the truth, exercise political control of opinion through the media, manipulate defendants and witnesses at public trials, and imagine that they secure their tyranny by strangling and repressing everything they consider thought crimes. That is from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2499. And this is from the Catechism segment on the use of the social communications media. It also says it's very important for us to discern properly. Paragraph 2496, the means of social communication, especially the mass media, can give rise to a certain passivity among users, making them less than vigilant consumers of what is said or shown. Users should practice moderation and discipline in their approach to the mass media. They will want to form enlightened and correct consciences and more easily to resist unwholesome influences. I mean, this is timeless teaching of the Church addressing exactly what we are talking about this morning with Todd McMurdy and the recent not guilty verdict that came down on Friday with Kyle Rittenhouse, but also the overall way the media have been approaching this story, just as in the case of Nicholas Sammon, whom Todd represents, where they put out a particular agenda. There's a confirmation bias. There was conjecture. Here was a white young man, talking about Sammon now, wearing a MAGA hat at a pro-life event, right? So here's the media. I can see them salivating, Todd, when this whole thing was going on with Nicholas. Oh, he's white. He's from a Catholic school. He's at this crazy pro-life event, and he's wearing a hat in support of Donald Trump. This is just perfect. Of course he did all of this. Of course he did what the Native American activists are accusing him of. And so many people, even in the Catholic Church, rushed to judgment, and then later some of them at least had the decency to, including some bishops, issue apologies. So, I mean, this continues to happen. Now, from a legal standpoint, is that all people can do is to possibly sue in order to control this type of craziness in the press?
I mean, legally, yes. I think that this is the only pathway available to people when the press comes after them. And it's a challenging pathway for a lot of people just because of the standards that apply to these cases. You know, for example, judges determine whether statements are defamatory or not. So a jury may not even get to hear some cases that should be heard. So you could see a circumstance where, you know, they allege a racist misconduct against somebody, you know, some act that is, you know, racist in nature, and a judge might rule against it. Not let it go to trial. So there is some uncertainty with any of these cases when you do that. But other than legal action, I'm not aware of what else we could do. There's probably a lot of business things that could be done to mm-hmm. fix this. And I wish some of our Republican billionaires would step forward and do that, you know, buy a CNN or CBS and have, you know, another outlet for proper news reporting. And I think once that started to happen, people would really go to that as a source of news instead of the biased news that they're getting today.
So given that it really is subjective on the part of the judge, you still think that Rittenhouse has a very strong case, and it keeps piling up. We were chatting during the break. Give us your sense of what he can do, given how bad the situation is with the way the media are covering this and continue to do so.
Yeah, what I think he should do is he should, you know, catalog all the different comments and instances of comments that people made. He ought to look at the different jurisdictions and find out what law is most favorable to him. I think he's from Illinois, but this occurred in Wisconsin, so he could look at both of those states as a place to bring his lawsuits. And then I think he ought to, you know, bring a lawsuit per comment. So for everybody that said he's a white supremacist, then he could put them in a lawsuit and bring those and just test the waters with these different things. And he'd maybe have a couple of different cases so that he might have an opportunity for one of them to succeed where maybe another fails. But yeah, I think he has plenty to do, and it'll be interesting to watch it all roll out.
Talking with Todd McMurdy, the attorney who was representing Nicholas Sammon in ongoing cases against the media and the way they attempted to ruin his reputation. Boy, has he, I mean, he was always very mature. I thought he handled the whole situation, Nicholas, from beginning to end, far beyond his years. And I saw an interview of him, I think it was Friday night, And boy, he's really grown in terms of really becoming a very strong young man. And he had a lot of very insightful things to say about the situation. I think even sent a message to Kyle to kind of encourage him. And I think the point that I was making before the break is super important. We can have separate discussions about gun issues. We can have separate discussions about whether someone should have been there at the time and how they approached it or what they did. But when you're in a, and I know you're not a criminal lawyer, but when you are looking at a case like this, what people need to understand is when you're going in there, it's supposed to be based on the facts. It's not to be used as something to paint a new, you know, statement for society on whatever issue, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has to be, you know, grounded in facts and reason before you're going to, you know, pursue claims or publish stories, whichever it may be.
Were you surprised that it even got to trial? Because there are some attorneys saying that there was so obvious a case of self-defense it never should have even been brought forth.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, I'm not a criminal lawyer, and I, you know, we discussed this briefly. You know, the whole idea of you know, should a prosecution be brought when it's not justified? And the answer, of course, is no. But you see that, you know, the influence that, you know, having a symbolic prosecution of Kyle Rittenhouse with the hope that, you know, that they're going to get a verdict against him and put him in jail, even though they know that it was fairly obvious from the beginning that he was acting in self-defense. Just kind of it perverts the system and brings about bad outcomes. And unfortunately, the jury in this circumstance gave us the right outcome and, you know, did the right thing. So we still have that, and I think we have to be very thankful that we have judges and juries that can still go into a jury room and reach a just verdict. And you know, right now that's probably the main tool that we have protecting people from the onslaught of the left and the less agenda. So we're blessed to have that for sure.
Yeah, the left really cannot stand it when the agenda goes against that. Well, when the reality strikes up against their agenda, basically, and this is why they're losing their minds over this. Can the attorneys and the prosecutors in the case, what's available legally to take them to task? Because that's another issue that was brought up over the weekend, and it's really important that the legal system is you know, applied properly, where people are not victimized. Because when you see what happened, this is like something you would think would happen in a third world country, you know, in a tyranny, as the church teaching says in the catechism, because of the mob mentality brought this case forward versus the reality of the situation when so many people said over and over again, this never should have even gotten that far in court.
Yeah, prosecutors have absolute discretion. In other words, they can, they can make decisions about cases without risk of being, called to task for that or being sued for that. So that's a near absolute point of discretion. The only option that people would have in this circumstance would be to, you know, run a political candidate to replace that person in office and get a different prosecutor in there who might not have bowed to the will of the mob in this circumstance.
But what about the Bar Association? Because they are licensed, they're officers of the court. What about corruption? Things like that can be investigated, correct?
Yes. I mean, I am on the Board of Governors for the Bar Association in Kentucky, so I'm pretty familiar with this. I'm not aware of anything that would hold a prosecutor to account for, prosecution in this circumstance with regard to the rules of ethics. If there was some corruption, of course, that's subject to criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you had a dirty prosecutor who, for whatever, took a payoff to do something, you know, that's a crime, and that could be investigated, but that's just kind of a speculative position at this point. You know, more likely than not, the prosecutors in the Rittenhouse matter simply decided to proceed no matter what, and they did so, and then they lost, and, you know, thank goodness they did.
Now, there's a lot of questions being raised about Joe Biden. He made some very bad comments about Rittenhouse last year, and he was a private citizen at the time. Obviously, it was before he moved into the White House. Can he be sued, even though he's in the White House now?
Yes, he can. Interestingly enough, when Paula Jones sued Bill Clinton way back in the day, the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a decision in that case and basically said that no man is above the law. and said that even when a president commits a wrong as a private act, in other words, something not a part of his job as president, he can be sued for that. And Paula Jones did have a defamation claim as a part of her claims against then President Clinton. And also, although it was recently dismissed, the courts allowed a defamation claim against President Trump to go forward. So in this circumstance, as you said, President Biden was not in office at the time, so he doesn't have any excuse. He was operating as a political candidate and using this young man's life as a way to get elected and to, you know, damage his reputation as a means to getting elected. So he certainly could be sued right away. And I think that the basis for the lawsuit, you know, what I've seen and looked into is there was a tweet on September 30th of 2020 that said that President Trump in the debate had refused to disavow white supremacy. And then it had a video, and in that video you see Kyle carrying an AR-15 rifle.
Right.
And so what that tells me is that there is an allegation of racist misconduct alleged against him, and we now know that from the facts that was not at all true. So it is a classic example of, you know, of a solid defamation claim arising from allegations of racist misconduct. And I think to have the president of the United States or a candidate for president and now president of the United States, former vice president, you know, long-term senator, attack you in the way that Biden did, demands a response. We just can't allow this to happen. And it'll be an interesting deposition when President Biden has to answer for what he said about Kyle. It'll be interesting to see how he's able to withstand cross-examination in that circumstance.
So maybe you can't answer this question, but the reporter in me is going to throw it out there anyway. Are you reaching out to Kyle, or is Kyle's family reached out to you?
No. I have this kind of parallel track, and people started asking me to comment. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of dug in and brought myself up to speed on everything that was going on. I don't know Kyle or his attorneys certainly would be willing to help them if they asked. You know, this is kind of a specialized area, and I've been able to really dig in and learn it, as a result of representing Nicholas Sandman.
Yeah.
But I'd be happy to advise him. You know, just that here's what you do, you know, or advise his lawyers, you know, just tell them what to do, because I think I know exactly what to do, having done it.
As long as you've been an attorney and you've been at this for a while, did you ever think it would be so totally out of control and insanity? I mean, the comments that these media folks and others are making and the spin they're putting on, there are even international media still reporting that Kyle Rittenhouse killed two minorities, and when all white people, and then we're pro-life from womb to tomb, and I'm not, you know, talking about the fact that this wasn't tragic overall, but they're reporting that there were minorities that were killed. But it's a crazy, just like with the Nicholas Sandman case, maybe even worse, the exact opposite of what happened is what the media are reporting. Did you ever think it would get this bad in all of your years of experience?
No, it's hard to believe. And I tell some of the younger attorneys I work with that it's really dramatically different than it was, you know, even 20 years ago. Things are, you know, the landscape, everything has changed so much that it's just very hard to comprehend where we are. And I tell that to them so that they maybe have some perspective and understand that this is not what most people would consider normal. You know, it's not normal at all. But, you know, you've got this, what I think there's an author named Rod Dreher who wrote this book, Live Not by Lies. And in that book, he talks about soft totalitarianism. And the dramatic change is really just an effort, you know, by academia, the elites, the press, large swaths of government to enforce this kind of soft totalitarianism and to so scare everybody into submission by, destroying lives through this woke political correctness, you know, political correctness on steroids, that they're willing to do anything. And,
right.
And that's just really where we are. That's the only thing that can explain your question is why do they continue to do this? Because they're doing it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my view just based on everything that I've done.
Well,
I
agree. There's an agenda, and that agenda is going to go forward. You know, truth be darned, and they're going to continue with it. Todd, thanks for your insight and your experience, and God bless you for your work and helping others get at the truth. Todd McMurdy, representing Nicholas Sandman, talking about the Rittenhouse case and the media approach. I'm going to wrap up the show today after the break with some resources. from the One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Faith regarding exactly what we are talking about and our responsibility as consumers when it comes to the media. We'll be right back.
When I heard other business owners say they finally found someone in the credit card industry they can trust, I wondered how he could help me. So when Mark from Schisler CPC offered to show me where all the money goes for credit card processing with a free analysis of my business, I jumped on it. He reviewed how the industry works, where we could save, and offered a no-contract guarantee on savings and excellent customer service. I'm saving thousands of dollars a year. Schisler CPC. Trust in them.
More information available on the Ave Maria website under Sponsor Business Directory.
Weingarts, everything from lawn to snow.
Hi, I'm Dan Weingarts. Our family is celebrating 75 years of helping families like yours choose the right power equipment for your lawn. Our experts will help you choose the right product from top brands like Steel. From legendary chainsaws, dependable trimmers, and powerful blowers, a Steel is designed for reliability and built for the long haul. Visit us to see the full Steel line at Weingarts.com.
Weingarts.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Genthe Automotive Group is a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio. The Genthe Group of Chevrolet, Honda, and Honda Power Sports is pleased to serve the Ave Maria audience with outstanding sales and service for all of Metro Detroit. As we emerge from this difficult year, the Genthe family is committed to honest and professional support for all the transportation needs of your family. They're ready to serve you 24/7 when you Google G-E-N-T-H-E. May God bless all of you.
Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraphs 2493 through 2499 on the use of social communications media. We also have John Paul II's Rapid Development, of apostolic letter, Rapid Development. And we also have one of my favorite world communications statements from him on the media from 2004, The Media, A Risk and a Richness. And we'll put those in our archive section. Talk to you tomorrow. Ciao, ciao.
You've been listening to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo. Catholic Connection is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Our producer is Andrew Kruczek. For copies of this program or for more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Thanks for listening and join us next time for another edition of Catholic Connection.